Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, taking you behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the hottest shows on Broadway, off Broadway, and beyond. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to the writer and performer Asif Manvi. You're most likely to recognize him from his years as a correspondent on The Daily Show, or from the films and TV shows in which he's appeared, like HBO's The Brink or Netflix's A Series of Unfortunate Events. But he got his start on stage. His breakout came in the one-man show he wrote and starred in, Sakina's Restaurant, winning an Obie Award for the 1998 play that looks at a cross-section of the immigrant experience as lived by a handful of characters, all played by Manvi himself. 2 decades later, he and the theater production arm of Audible are reviving the show for an off-Broadway run that arrives on a political and cultural landscape that's very different than it was 20 years ago. Hey, Asif. Thanks for joining me.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
How's your show going?
Good. Yeah. This is show 5, 7, something like that. Yeah. You know, I think I'm finally now having fun with it.
Right.
It takes a little while. Yeah. I feel like now I'm finally in that. Last night I felt like was the first show that I did where I, you know, there's always that moment when you're doing a play where you realize that, like, you're running the play and the play's not running you,
right.
You know? And so yeah. I feel like I'm getting to that point now with this run where I felt like last night was the first night that I was sort of in control of the show rather than the show. So that was good. That was a nice feeling.
Let's start at the beginning for Sakina's Restaurant. So where were you in your life when you first wrote it and what prompted you to do it?
I was in Queens.
Okay.
And you had
studied in Florida because you eventually ended up in Florida and studied theater there.
My parents moved our family to Florida in the early 80s.
Right. And that was after London?
In England. I grew up in a city called Bradford in the north of England.
Right.
And so I used to have this northern accent like that, just like that, you know, that. And I went from that to like Florida, you know.
Yeah.
And and then people just thought I was from New York because the melding of the American and the northern Yorkshire accent, people were just like, are you from New York? So I always felt like a New Yorker in my heart anyway, but I lived in Florida for many years and went to school there and started working there at Disney in Orlando and all that, doing like comedy improv.
Okay, I was going to ask what you did there.
I was part of a sketch comedy group called Streetmosphere, which is still there, I think.
Awesome.
It was sort of the beginning of like, it was great comedy training, especially right out of school, you know? And anyway, then I moved to New York and started auditioning for theater and stuff. And At that time, in the mid-90s, there were no parts for a young, incredibly handsome brown man. Yeah. So, it was frustrating. You know, I would occasionally get a part on, like, you know, New York Undercover or one of those shows that was airing at the time. You know, it was shooting here, of like a deli owner or three lines as a cab driver, and it was frustrating because I went out to L.A. for pilot season in 1996 and literally did not have a single audition. And all of my, like, Caucasian friends were booking pilots and, you know, auditioning. And I just sat in my apartment in L.A. for 3 months, and the phone rang maybe once, you know.
And it was your mom.
And it was, yeah. Exactly. And they were like, do you know how to snake charm? I was like, I don't know how to snake charm.
So you were here and you decided
so
to
I was,
write something?
Yeah,
yourself?
So when I came back to New York, I thought, well, you know what I'm going to do? I'd already been working on this show idea because I was a big fan of Bogosian and Leguizamo and those guys, and I thought...
Yeah, I could see all of those sort of influencing that when I saw
and
it.
I sort of thought, you know, I can write a one-man show. And I wanted to write characters that felt true, that felt authentic, and you know, felt like they came out of my American experience, my immigrant experience. Right. They came out of sort of my DNA, you know. And there were no characters like that. There were no characters in theater that I could see. You know, I could in theater I would get work, you know, doing plays, but it was always like it was either in Shakespeare where, you know, you always have multiracial casting, and then or I would be aping, you know, sort of white American plays and characters, are doing Death of a Salesman or, you know, Eugene O'Neill or whatever, and so Tennessee Williams, you know, stuff like that. So even in class, I was always like, and so there were no roles that felt like, oh, they came out of my experience or that I felt connected to. So I started writing these characters inspired by my family.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are any of them based on real people or just
The parents are definitely based on my real parents. And the rest of the, they're all part of me. They're all, you know, as I've evolved and had more therapy, I realized that, like, you know, they're all aspects of my own multiplicity and my own self. So it felt like, this is, you know, and then I just started writing, and I started studying with Win Handman at the he was the artistic director of the American Place Theater, where we ended up doing the show. But I studied with him in his acting class, and Win sort of helped me with the tools of how to shape these characters and how to, you know, he had worked with Leguizamo and Bogosian and people like that. And so he helped me construct the characters into a theatrical form, because I would come in and I just have these ranting monologues, and then he would be like, "All right, now we need a little theater. You know, we need the structure." You know, so he would, like, even with the father character, I remember Wynn was the one who sort of said, "You know, maybe the phone keeps ringing all the time," and so he gets distracted. He has to keep on dealing with customers while he is, you know, and that was a very fundamental way of writing a monologue that I didn't know at that time, you know, and so he was the one who sort of, like, got me and shaped them. So it took a few years, and then eventually he produced it at the American Place Theater.
And it ran for about 6 months, you said earlier. Yeah.
It ran for 6 months. It did quite well.
It won a couple
of Obie Awards. We took it to Toronto. We took it to L.A. We took it to London at the Bush Theater.
And was that your breakout? Do you think of it as your...
It was the beginning for me. Like, it was Ismail Merchant of Merchant Ivory came and saw the play after the New York Times review came out, and then he cast me as the lead in his film, The Mystic Masseur.
Right.
And so that was my first real big movie role, and I like to think that was when, like, sort of people sort of started to know, oh, this Asimov, you know, like, who he is. I mean, of course, The Daily Show then became, like, another level altogether, but that was when it sort of first... I feel like that was my first step in my career, yeah.
Is Sakina's Restaurant based on an actual restaurant on East 6th Street?
No.
And if so, which one? And what should I order? That's what I was going to ask.
Go ahead. You can try it. They're all,
it's the one with all the lights hanging down,
exactly,
right?
Yeah. It's got lights. It's got like, you know, cheesy pictures of the Taj Mahal.
There's only one. Yeah.
You know the one I'm talking
yeah,
about.
Exactly.
No, it's they're all sort of aspects of Sakina's restaurant,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And so this was back in 1998. This was 3 years before 9/11 and
yeah.
many years before, you know, Trump sort of started,
yeah.
you know, made immigration
yeah.
kind of put it at the forefront of the national conversation.
Right.
How did it land then politically, or did it land as a political kind of statement?
It wasn't a political play. It was, you know, this was, like you said, it was before 9/11. And at that time, I even have a joke in the show about, you know, Americans not knowing what Muslims are, you know. And
right.
I think that at that point, it was very...
That might have gotten my biggest laugh, the answer with that it was a kind of cotton or something.
Right. Yeah. Right. So it was, you know, it felt like at that time it was a story about immigrants. It was a story about a family coming. It was about the disillusionment of the American dream, the sacrifice, the joys, whatever. But it didn't feel political. It felt like a very... And then, you know, that after 9/11, Muslims became politicized. The word Muslim, the idea of Islam, suddenly everyone was like, what is this religion? Why did this happen to us? There was a whole question of like, the Quran was, people were buying the Quran like, you know, out of right. Barnes and Nobles. It was just flying off the shelves, which it can do by itself, by the way. It's the
right.
Quran.
That's
so
true.
It knows how to fly. And so... you know, and suddenly there was a whole different, but when we did, so now it feels like, you know, and again, it was pre-internet as well.
Oh, right.
So
yeah.
That's another, you know, and so now it feels like the world has evolved and devolved in different ways, you know, but
yeah. Did you think of it as a political, do you feel like you as an artist have sort of engaged in politics in the way that you did sort of most overtly on The Daily Show? Like, is that a thing that you've always kind of done, or?
No, actually I was never a political artist. I've always been a storyteller, and that's been my milieu. And, you know, when I got on The Daily Show, suddenly I realized I had this platform and I could talk about things that I realized I wanted to talk about, but I didn't know how to or have a platform. And so suddenly sitting on that fence between cultures, being an immigrant and being American at the same time, and having this kind of multiple identity kind of thing allowed me to talk about things on The Daily Show that some of the other correspondents couldn't often talk about. And I was the first non-white correspondent on The Daily Show.
Right.
So they benefited from that because suddenly they had this like.
And that was when? That was 2006.
Oh, it was 2006. Six, yeah. And so once, you know, I had that platform, and then that in a strange way sort of activated my activist bone and allowed me to find my political voice or my activist voice. And so now it almost feels like Sakina's Restaurant does feel in a strange way political, because the conversation around immigrants, the conversation around Muslims is so different and so much. You know, when we were discussing Sakina's Restaurant, the revival.
Yeah, bring it back. This is with Audible, we should
with
say.
Audible,
with
yes.
Audible, so that we'll also record an audio version and release it
as an audio
subsequently. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And so when Audible approached me initially, it was, you know, the Muslim ban was happening. And
right.
soon after that, you had little kids being put into cages and separated from their parents at the border. And suddenly this conversation about immigration, this conversation about who's an American and who's allowed into this country and what does it mean to be an American, suddenly
right.
this conversation became so much at the forefront of our national consciousness again, that it felt like weirdly Sakina's Restaurant was relevant again, you know, in a humanizing way.
Right, yeah. And what do you find now? It doesn't sound like it's much changed from the version that
No, we've made some edits, we've made some cuts, but we haven't changed the story. And we've actually said it in the time period that
yeah.
it was written.
Right.
So it was, we said it in the late 90s.
It was an excellent vintage Game Boy.
That
must have been worth some money.
I don't know where they got that from. And of course, on the second day of rehearsal, I broke it.
Yeah.
So, you know, they spent like, I think, about $15,000
yeah.
to get that Game
sure.
Boy, like a vintage game. And then I, like, the second day of rehearsal, I drop it, and the thing falls out, and they're like, oh my God. And I was like, I'm so sorry. But no, but it was, it's actually very similar to the one that we used originally.
In the, yeah. Yeah. And so what do you find lands differently or hits home in a different way now as opposed to then?
Well, you know, it's, I think that people, there's a nostalgia for a kind of American identity that we feel like we have lost as a nation, I think. And there's a kind of, on one hand, there's a kind of nostalgia around who we see ourselves as and the America that we, you know, and I think that's one aspect of it. The another aspect of this is immigrants, I think, still see themselves very much in the play, whether you're an Indian immigrant or a Turkish or, you know, whatever, where, if you've come to this country. I mean, I had a young woman the other night who was a Chinese American, and she was like, she saw the show and she was like, that's my father, you know, that's my story. So I think the immigrant story hasn't really changed in terms of the American story of immigrants. There are things, of course, in the text that it's funny. I have this one line where one of the characters says, any ordinary in America, any ordinary idiot can become rich. Right. And it never used to get a laugh.
Right.
It was not written as a laugh line.
Right.
And now it, there's inevitably a chuckle in the audience. Like at least 10 people will chuckle at that line. Or I feel a resonance in the audience that, that was never there before.
Yeah, so it feels very pointed now. Yeah,
yeah. Right. So little things like that obviously have changed. But the story itself is a story about a family and a story about their struggles and joys. So that hasn't changed. And I don't think it it really does, you know.
Yeah. Have you recorded the audio version yet?
Not yet. We're going to do it soon, though, yeah.
Will that require some changes just in terms of, because you accomplished some of the sort of transitions with, you know, costume elements.
Yeah, I don't know how we're going to exactly do that. I think we'll probably use music and maybe there'll be some narration in terms of, like, this is what's happening.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So this is the first time you've been on stage in New York since you were in the off-Broadway version of Disgraced,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
How was it being back?
It's great. You know, I mean,
do you enjoy doing plays?
I do. And theater is my first love. So, a lot of people think of me because of The Daily Show as a comedian, as a stand-up. And I do stand-up. And I've been doing, ironically, my career went in, like, I got on The Daily Show and then I started doing stand-up as opposed to the other way around, which for a lot of people. But theater is where I sort of my origin story is from. So I love going back to the theater. And, you know, and Sakina's Restaurant, like I said, is, you know, it's not only a play that I wrote and I feel very close to, but it's also a way for me to tell a story about, you know, brown people that nobody else was telling. And then when I did Disgraced a few years ago, Aya Doctor's play, that was the first time since Sakina's Restaurant that I saw a play with a South Asian man that felt like it resonated with me, that felt like it was a true, nuanced, complicated portrayal, you know?
Right, yeah. And you ended up not joining that production on Broadway because you were working on The Brink, is that
yeah,
right?
Or, yeah, yeah. It was really one of the big heartbreaks of my career that I couldn't do it on Broadway because it was a wonderful position to be in, but I was doing this HBO series called The Brink with Jack Black and Tim Robbins, and we couldn't make
it.
You
were also a writer on, right?
Which I also got hired as a writer on, and so it was an amazing experience. But it was sad that I couldn't do Disgraced on Broadway. And you know,
although you had been on Broadway in the Trevor Nunn Oklahoma in 2002.
I was in which again I feel like was a direct result of my sort of original Sakina's Restaurant thing, and then people, so Trevor came and auditioned me for, and that was a weird thing because I again never done a musical. I've done things where I feel like I shouldn't. This I did not predict doing this in my career. Like a musical on Broadway was not on my checklist.
Would you do another? You know? That's one of my questions. Would you do another? Like, is that a thing? I'd love to do another musical.
I did Brigadoon at the City Center.
Oh, wait, that's right.
Like
yeah.
last year, yeah. And with Patrick Wilson again and Kelly O'Hara and all those guys. And of course, I didn't. I get cast as the guy who doesn't sing, like the funny guy in the musical. You know?
Do you sing?
I do, but not, you know, when I heard Patrick Wilson singing for the first time in rehearsals at Oklahoma. We did our first rehearsals at the National Theater in London, and we started there.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I remember, like, the first week of rehearsals for Oklahoma, Trevor said, no singing. You know, everyone's just going to, when you get to the songs, you just talk them. And so we did that. And you know, I'd never been in a musical before. I didn't know what to expect. I'd only done straight plays. And then one day he says, okay, we're going to sing now. And then Patrick Wilson opened his mouth and started singing. And I was like, oh, I really should not be here. Like, what is happening? You know, and suddenly I felt like I was in a completely different universe. But I had a patter song.
Which
was great, and it was a lot of fun. Oklahoma was so much fun. And I did it for a year, and it was just the best time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any more plays in you, as a writer? Do you think?
Well, you know, I actually have a commission at Lincoln Center for a play that I'm supposed to be writing.
Lincoln Center, which is where Disgraced started out in New
right.
York.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And so I currently. Have a commission from them to write a play.
How's that going?
It's coming along. There's a play on my computer which is about 742 pages, and that I've been writing for about 8 years, and I have no idea.
Did that originate around the time of Disgraced or before that?
No, it was actually right after 9/11. I started writing a play, and I don't know if it's ultimately going to end up being a one person show again or something like that. I'd like to do another one person show and figure that out.
Why?
Why?
What is it about?
I like the medium. I hate other actors, I don't like sharing the spotlight. No, I like the medium, and I like the ability to, you know, one of the great aspects of Sakina's Restaurant is that. There's the story of a character who becomes other people and then therefore moves through his own journey and stuff. And I like that shape-shifting kind of quality of, like, seeing one story told through multiple perspectives, you know, in that way. And maybe it will be with other actors as well. I mean, I'm not entirely opposed to other actors. Yeah. They have their good points.
Yeah. And you alluded to this a little bit earlier, but in the 20 years since you first did Sakina's Restaurant, mm-hmm. how have you seen opportunities for, you know, actors of Indian descent or Southeast Asian actors or Muslim American actors or even non-white actors in general? How have you seen them? How have those opportunities expanded, or have they?
They have. Anyway? I mean, you see a lot more. You know, they keep calling it diversity, which always is a dirty word to me. But, you know, it is much more about representation and about, like, people, stories being told that are multiple and have multiple perspectives. And so I feel like we are seeing more stories now. We are seeing, you know, with Master of None and with Mindy and, mm-hmm. you know, there are South Asian actors, Crazy Rich Asians, you know.
Right.
We are seeing a multiplicity of stories. And that helps us, I think, as a culture and as a society that not all the stories are about white people. But still, having said that, there is a sense that what's considered quote-unquote normal is still stories about white people, you know,
right.
and so we don't, you know, I make the joke that, like, we have the story Crazy Rich Asians, but we need a story that was just like normal Asians, you know, not they're not crazy or rich, you know,
right.
and that's the thing still, that, like, there is this sense that, like, when you tell a story about people of color, it has to be like the worst thing that ever happened or the greatest thing that ever, you know, it's got to be like, you know, that movie, what was the one about the three black women that saved NASA, you know?
Oh, yeah. Invisible Figures.
Hidden Figures.
Thank you. Yes.
Good.
Invisible
Figures.
We got there.
Maybe better.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, that, a story like that where it's like they saved NASA. That's how high the bar is set for them to make a movie about three black women. It's got to be like, you know, meanwhile, you've got, like, you know, Jennifer Lawrence making that movie Joy, which is about a white woman that invented a mop. Like,
right.
That's the story. You know what I mean? And you're like, okay, so this is where
right.
it is, you know?
Right.
So, like, when we can tell stories like that, you know, I have a whole, it's like if that was a Muslim woman and I was like, oh, her name is Fatima and she invents a mop. No, we're not making that story.
Yeah.
Like, you know?
So how do we get there? Do we just keep telling more stories?
I think we just keep telling more stories. I think we tell and look, it's happening. You know, there are more writers, there are more storytellers. I think, and that's where it is. I think it's like in the kind of, where I will use the word diversity, the diversity of stories, you know, and the sort of sense of there's a larger palette of the American experience that we can talk about, you know, and that's happening. And it's interesting that right now, as we are seeing a progressiveness towards that in our culture, we are also seeing a reaction to that, right. You know, and Trump, I think, is the reaction to that movement towards progressivism and that movement towards inclusiveness and representation that is happening, and we're seeing a reaction of nativism and populism and sort right. of, you know, shutting our borders and building walls and all that stuff yeah. as well.
Yeah. You mentioned that your career had taken you in places that you never thought you'd go.
Yeah.
Where would you like it to go that it hasn't been yet? Where, what would you like to explore that you
haven't done? You know, I've never starred in my own TV show. And that would be something I would love to
I was watching
do.
Sakina's Restaurant, and I thought, well,
this could be a TV show
right here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, I haven't done that yet. I would like to, you know, be at the helm of, like, something that I am creating. You know, I did today's yeah. special, which was the film that was inspired by Sakina's Restaurant.
Right.
And, right. And you know, and I want to produce more. I'd like to, you know, it's a classic. I want to direct, you know. Right. But I do. I have things. I have more stories that I want to tell, and that's a thing I want to either whether I am acting in them or producing them or whatever. There are many more stories that I want to tell. You know, but it has been. I've been lucky and fortunate in a way because I don't like to do the same thing for too long. You know, when I'm doing comedy all the time, I itch to do dramatic work, and it was so great on The Daily Show because John was very. Cognizant of that, and he would let me go off and do other things, so I got to go do Disgraced or
right.
you know, The Last Airbender or whatever it was, right. you know, where
was comedy a surprise to you in terms of what you as an actor, were you always sort of
I was always doing comedy
comically, you know, inclined.
Yeah, when you go to theater school, you know, you kind of do both. You never think about it really, you know, you're like, but I always was a comedic actor as well as a dramatic actor, and so I enjoy both, but right. I like being able to go back and forth and you know, and like I said, I've had like the weirdest, you know, career so far. Like it's like I got to do Oklahoma on Broadway, which is a musical. I got to do a Merchant Ivory film, which, mm-hmm. you know, and then I got to be on The Daily Show. It's a very right. sort of like, I, you know, the resume is sort of like, who is this guy? You know, but I think that as I've gotten older, I've sort of learned to embrace that sense of like multiplicity that like I really am a person who enjoys doing different things. And Sakina's Restaurant is an embodiment of that, you know?
Yeah. And what's on your plate immediately coming up after this? You're in the show for the next few weeks.
Yeah. So I have a show that I'm developing with Apple mm-hmm. That me and my wife actually created.
Great.
And it's more of a throwback to my Daily Show sort of non-scripted world.
Oh, okay.
So it's a non-scripted show. So I'm developing that with Apple, and I have a couple of other
news-based.
It's sort of like in that yeah. realm. Yeah, it's kind of what sort of in the realm of what we did in terms of the field pieces we did on the Daily
yeah,
Show.
Okay.
So it's sort of that sort of thing. And then I have some other writing projects that I'm developing and stuff. And then I'm doing a recurring on Blue Bloods this season,
oh, yes,
which
right.
is kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, you live here in New York, right?
I live yeah. here in New York, yeah, yeah. yeah. So there's some projects that I'm producing and creating,
right.
you know, in the next few months.
And when will we see this play, your new play?
My new play?
Yeah, your
oh,
new play.
The one that Lincoln,
yeah.
That well, that's a very good question. Yeah, you know, I think Lincoln Center is asking the same thing.
Sure.
Like, when they gave me the commission, they said, "Now don't take 10 years to write this play," and I was like, "I absolutely won't." And you know, now I'm worried that.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I want to. This has actually gotten me inspired again because I sort of was, you know, what's so interesting about this business is that one of the gifts of this business is when you can get to do what you want to do the way you want to do it and sort of see your thing, that's a very rare thing in this business because often in television and Hollywood, you get so sort of like inundated with everybody else's kind of like, you know, your what the network mandate is or whatever. You know what I mean? And you're at the sort of mercy of like executives and people who are in charge of your creative voice and whether you get to tell your story to the world. And so this has sort of inspired me again, because I've been in that world for a while now where it's like sometimes really frustrating, you know. You feel like, oh, you can't get your story out there because we have another show with a brown person on it or whatever it is. You know, we still can't have two Muslim stories at the same time. What? You know, so it's sort of like the theater, you know, sometimes feels like, oh, okay, it feels like a refuge for me, like, you know, where I can go back and tell the story the way I want to tell it. So actually doing Sakinas has inspired me to, like, get back into that other play that I was working on.
Can you tell us anything about it?
It was originally written, it was written after 9/11. I started writing it, and it's about a relationship between an older Pakistani Muslim man and the woman that he was in love with when he was young, and he goes back to see her after his wife died. And it's kind of a sort of a nostalgic sort of piece, but I don't know if it's that anymore, because there's a whole other elements to it. Like I said, it's literally like hundreds of pages long right now, and I have monologues and scenes. And, you know, I'm sort of writing in a very Stephen Adley Gergis kind of way, where I'm just sort of like writing scenes that just come out of nowhere and then figuring out like how they all connect at some point, which is how I wrote Sakinas, you know. It was never written. I'm not a linear writer. I don't write like Sakinas was sort of written hodgepodge, kind of like a character here, a character there, and then I figured out, and then Özge was the last character. Özge's the narrator
of
the
show. Yeah, he's the narrator of the show.
He was the last character to be created, and because I needed a vehicle, and then I realized, oh, he's the main character.
He's the way in, yeah.
You know, and so that's kind of what's happening with this play, which is that I'm sort of writing scenes and monologues and characters, and then I'm going to have to figure out how to do it all, and then figure out if I want to play all those people or want to just cast them, you know. It's there. It's on my computer, I swear to God.
All right.
If Lincoln Center is listening, I have a play on my computer. I just need to get it to you.
Excellent. Well, we can't wait to see it whenever it arrives.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Asif.
Thanks.
Nice to talk to you.
You too.
That was Asif Manvi, now starring off-Broadway in Sakinas Restaurant, with an audio version of the play soon to be available from Audible. If you like what you've heard on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes and subscribe wherever finer podcasts are dispensed. On the next episode of Stagecraft, I'll be talking to the veteran actor Christopher Lloyd about his role in Pound, a new off-Broadway play about the poet Ezra Pound. Until then, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.